You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. Second City is excited to work with Amazon as part of their new and exciting app called AMP. AMP is a home where anyone can create live radio-style shows alongside some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry, including ours. Join the Second City live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time for our show, Second City Public Radio. SCPR is an interactive weekly lampoon of all things public radio. Each week, our host and an ever-expanding panel of Second City characters open up the lines to listeners from around the U.S. to ask questions and offer us opinions on a slew of wide-reaching subjects. Download the app and don't forget to tune in AMP Thursdays at 5 p.m. Central Time. So this is a cool conversation. I'm talking to Ross Dawson, who's a world-leading futurist, entrepreneur, and keynote speaker. And he's got a great new book. It's called Thriving on Overload, The Five Powers for Success in a World of Exponential Information. Enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Ross Dawson, welcome to the show.
Wonderful to be here.
So I'm reading your new book, Thriving on Overload. And I'm thinking to myself, man, there's so much crossover around improvisation. And indeed, I get to page 168, and you do talk about improvisation. You mentioned Second City and Yes And, so you're kind of the perfect guest for the Second City Getting to Yes And podcast. So let's start there. When and how does improvisation show up in your work and in this book in particular?
So for me, it is a way of letting ourselves free. And this is, we are constrained. We are built up with all of our lives, all of our education, all of it is about keeping ourselves in. Whereas improv is about letting out what is inside us. So this falls in the book in the chapter on synthesis. So the book, the subtitle of the book is The Five Powers for Success in a World of Exponential Information. And the final, the fifth one, is that of synthesis. And in our, I suppose, again, taking in that parallel between contemporary society and what is our potential, contemporary society is around analysis. It is around the breaking of things down into pieces. And whereas synthesis is the exact opposite, is the pulling together of the pieces into the whole. And our educational system teaches us to analyze, teaches us to break things down, to be analytical, to not see the whole, but to see the pieces. And this, one crude parallel is that the analysis is that of the conscious mind, where we are sort of thinking hard, whereas the unconscious mind is that which is below the surface, which pieces together the holes, which makes the connections. And that's what we need to do in this complex world, is to see the connections, see how the world fits together, to connect the dots, as it's often put, and make sense of the world in order to be able to see opportunities, to make better sense of the world, to be able to make better decisions in an extraordinarily complex world. And that comes from below the surface. And improv is a way of being able to let that mind free, to let those connections be made, to see the whole. So I think this is an extraordinary practice for anybody and everyone in order to facilitate that welling up, that capability, that potential, which is below the surface in most of us, and which in leaders in particular needs to be expressed.
Yeah, literally in my notes here, I have that I often refer to improv as human being practice. And when people ask me what I'm saying, if you know about Kahneman's work and System 1, System 2, the ability to go between rapidly, go between your System 1 and your System 2 is what happens when people are improvising. And I also thought it was interesting, and I was intrigued and actually bought the book that you mentioned. And this is the scholars John Cunius and Mark Beeman, whose research on insights notes that what's happening in the brain at the moment of an insight is linked to making distant connections, such as understanding humor and metaphors. And while improv and humor making are two different things, they are deeply connected, right? Because that's what we do.
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about that? Because I found that research brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And so John Cunius and Mark Beeman are two academics who came across each other. And they were both had this common interest of saying, what happens in the moment of insight? And that's something we all experience. And some at bigger scale than others, when Einstein suddenly saw the concept of the general theory of relativity, and many other Nobel Prize winners, it has been in an instant when they've seen this idea. They've pulled together different pieces to be able to have an insight, which was powerful. Yet all of us, we get, we say, that's, I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good idea. Or these different ways of connecting or seeing, or just in the process of learning something, you know, just as students at school or students as we are older, we work and we study and say, I don't quite get that. And then we say, I got it. So what these researchers found is that there is a state of our mind when we make those connections, which is part, of course, this process of synthesis, of seeing the whole. And this is, we can study this and we can nurture it. And what they found is that before that moment of insight, we often fall back into this, you know, what it describes the alpha state of our mind, when it was basically a state of relaxation, when before that we may have been in a state of excitation, where now brains are actually actively engaged. And one of the summaries that the authors came to is saying we need to cycle. The best way to nurture creativity is to cycle between that, essentially that analytical mind, mm-hmm. and that relaxed mind, so that we can sort of work out at a problem and then we let go of it and go for a walk in nature. We come back to that, and I think this is something we can learn to practice. And there's different cycles. As you say, that's part of what actually happens when you're on stage and something's coming out of your mouth. But it is also something I think through each day we can practice rather than say, okay, I'm going to really work really hard today. Well, in fact, you may be far more productive and creative if you work really hard and take a break. You work really hard and take a break and do things, completely different things. And so that's part of that cycle of engagement and disengagement of the brain underlies that capacity for creativity and connection making.
I was on a conference call earlier today with a small group. I'm going to do a panel on the power of play. And this is aimed at young girls. And one of the other panelists is, she runs a play lab for IDEO. And so we got to talking, and of course, design thinking has that same spirit where it's messy. And when you walk in there, you're like, yes, what is going on? But they're working on really difficult, complex problems. But the whole point of play, and this is the thing, I wonder your level of frustration that we have all this science around the way people learn, the need for mess and all those things. And yet so many of our school spaces, our university spaces, our workspaces do the exact opposite. They don't provide for any of that.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that's, you know, which goes to the broader point around education. Our education system is not what it could be. In many ways, including the fact that it is just focused on that analytical, and we can bring there's a lot of scope for improvement, let's say.
Yeah.
So that's what we need to bring to bear. And of course, in our formal education system, and the fact that, of course, education has to be lifelong, and we can bring that to bear throughout our lives.
Yep. In the introduction to your book, you write, quote, "Thriving on overload starts with the premise that who we are, our identities and lives and destiny, are framed by our relationship with information. Humans exist amidst information." That is a really fresh perspective I don't think I've heard on this podcast, but it certainly brings again elements that we've talked to people about. But talk about humans and relationship to information. And I think especially context becomes hugely important here.
Well, the first thing I suppose is, as a definition of information, information for me is anything that comes in through our senses.
Mm-hmm.
So if we hear something, if we see something, and that could be the sound of a baby crying, that's information. Then the tone of that baby crying, that's information. So it's not just when we look at a screen or a newspaper or a television channel that it's information. Information is everything, and what we catch out the corner of our eyes, we're driving along, that's information. And our brain processes everything that we take in. So that's the nature, that is the foundation of how humans have dominated the world.
Yeah.
Is we are, that's this progress. We have seen information and we've been better at processing and saying, aha, well, maybe if I do this, I can make a fire, or I can build a building, or what becomes a city, or how about a round wheel, put a few of them together and we make a car, and let's go to space. You're building on it. Use information, our ability to take in information to learn from others. So when we write things down, that's information as well, and we can learn from others. So we are information processing animals. That is the nature of what it is to be human. And this is a joy. This is the wonder of being human, is the fact that we have all of this and we make new things of it. Everybody is creative. And that's another thing I love about improv and the book Improv by Keith Johnston. I mean, one of the points he makes is that everyone who keeps on denying, I'm not creative. Well, in fact, no, you're extraordinarily creative just by denying you're creative. And this is so this taking in the information and making new things of it is what it is. We are, is what it is to be human. So this focus on saying, how do we make value from this information, be better at it, to discern the things which we should be seeing, to move our attention away from the obvious to the less obvious, to make sure that the things that the information which comes in serves us. We're not continuing to take in, all right, this is the tedious headlines of the day all the time, but actually looking for saying, this is inspiring, or this is something I can learn from, or this is intriguing, and to make sure that our information diet, the information we take in, is information that serves us, makes us better, makes us more able to come up with new ideas, and then let the wonder of who it is to be human to make new things of that, create wonders.
So let's talk about the five powers. The first one is purpose. And you do a semi-dangerous thing in the world we live in, which is you have nuance to this idea. And in many places, when people talk about purpose, it's like one thing. And yes. You seem to be suggesting in this book that there are many purposes at different times. And you have a lovely quote. You say, quote, "Have you ever doubted the trajectory of your life? I dearly hope so. The only way to find your path is through a process of discovery, which by its nature means sometimes or often going off track and then realizing it." And I love that, because it's such an improv thing, of course, of making mistakes work for you and seeing obstacles as gifts. It's this essential. If you can find the reframe, there's a yes there, right? There's potentially something bigger there.
Indeed, this way of framing, we have to make accidents. We have to make mistakes. There's no such thing as a perfect life, and in fact, the best lives are fraught with all sorts of falling into the ditch along the way. and picking ourselves up, maybe not on the side we thought, but on the other side, and there's something there. So this is where we need to be exploring. And again, as you say, this this worship of this idea of purpose. Oh, you have to have a purpose. Yes, we do. We do need some direction in life, something which draws us towards us. But making that too fixed is also dangerous.
Right.
We need to be continually discovering our purpose and our direction, and not just the, you know, that big frame of, you know, why I was born, but also the smaller things of, you know, this is the ways in which I can help, the ways in which I can enjoy myself, the experiences I can have, the role of being alive, and in many things, and those relationships between information. I think, you know, part of it is, you know, we are learning animals. So part of being information-based animals, we learn and we seek to learn. And one of the questions, one of our purposes is, what will I learn? You know, some people believe that learning is very pragmatic, and, you know, it can be and it should be, but I also believe that learning for its own sake. What would I love to learn? And that's one of our purposes, is learning for its own sake and learning to be able to apply that. Another one of our purposes is to be well, help others to be well. Another is to pursue our passions and understand that all of these are part of us and the directions in our life that help us guide the information that we use and how we put that into practice through our lives.
You also nod in this section around, and we've talked about this a bunch with like science writer, a former monk, a happiness expert, about where we choose to put our attention. And you write about this in the context of news. And I know that's something that my therapist and I have discussed many times, which is, she said, like, Kelly, you need to cool it with the political podcasts. Like, you consume a lot of information already. You read the New York Times, you've got NPR on. And I did. I found myself like engaging with this content, and it was not bringing me any joy. And I was not abdicating my responsibility, I think, as a good human being on this planet, because I vote and I try to keep informed. But it was just, it was stealing my attention in ways that I don't think it should.
Yes, this is one of the big frames around. We say, all right, we engage with the world of information and the news, and I think, you know, the political news is a big part of that. Sucks us in. It's that's the headlines. We see what is happening with our politicians. I think whoever you are, there are politicians that you hate. And that draws us into, it's again part of the flaws of human nature in a way. We start to be, you know, it can become obsessive and starting to see these things. So, and also, you know, many, many aspects of the news, the very fact of news itself, its negativity, the part of the negativity bias of our minds to looking for what is dangerous or difficult is starts to pull in. And of course, news itself is designed to suck us in, make us come back. You know, it's an industry and it's good at it. So all of these factors mean that almost every single one of us spend more time on the news than is good for us.
Yeah.
And so this is part of where we need to build in some practices and say, yeah, well, sure. Okay. I want to be informed. Every day I'm going to look at the news. Well, you know, not that that's essential, but fair enough. But for a specific period of time, then that's done. And then you can move on to some of the joy creating or value creating things in your lives, and leaving that slice of the news and with all of its, you know, often negative emotions associated with that aside.
I know we've nodded already to this, but the second power is framing. And I'm looking at my notes. I do extensive notes for these things. And one of them, I don't necessarily understand what I meant, because I wrote down just taking notes, but it's not in quotation marks. I think I probably know what it was in terms of the power and value in terms of writing stuff down and taking notes. I think that's maybe what that means. Or is it something else from that chapter?
Well, framing is building frameworks. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is that simply that information taken alone, any piece of information taken alone is probably very little value. It has value when it is connected to other pieces of information. So the frameworks that we build are ones that actually draw out what are the connections? Where does this fit? What are the ways in which I organize these ideas in my mind or in a piece of paper or in a piece of software? So note-taking is more than just writing things down, because that can just become a list. Yeah. And a list of things, all right, a list of links, a list of articles, a list of ideas. That's a starting point. But where it has value is when we build this into a framework, where we see the connections between things, you know, where it is that this a piece of information fits. Does this fit here? Does it fit somewhere else? Does it not have a place, in which case I need to refine my framework? And the key aspect of these frameworks is these are the foundations of our knowledge and our understanding. So we can vastly accelerate the development of our knowledge and understanding, not just by simply by taking notes and dumping things in a place which we don't look at them again, but in a way where there is some structure to it. And in the chapter, I draw out a few of the fundamental structures for how we connect the different pieces of information we see. But whatever it is that suits us or the topic, the ways in which we can take information, put that into a framework of where it connects in or fits, and thus vastly accelerate our development of knowledge and understanding.
I just had this thought as you were talking and I don't know if you've ever seen sort of like backstage at Saturday Night Live where they have post-it notes of like the scenes and that sort of thing, the order they go in. And this is something that they got from Second City, and Second City got it from vaudeville. But it's this idea of the elements of comedy review that can actually succeed much better if they are in a particular kind of order, and you learn about running order. My wife teaches this. She's a comedy professor. But it's interesting. I sort of realized, oh, like in a process when we're creating a show, there are hundreds of these cards that are pinned up, and they slowly start to have a shape. They get moved around. And sometimes crucially at the last minute, you just do move something there, and it just makes everything work better. And sometimes we don't know why, sometimes we do. But that's a little bit of that what you're talking about, correct?
Absolutely. So this is where you're laying out your ideas. And so, you know, this is my framework. This is my understanding of peace. This is the way it all fits together. And absolutely, this is where you can move things around. So one of the people I interviewed for my Thriving on Overload podcast, you know, what I describe as information masters and how that works, she uses a murder board, what she describes as. And so, you know, the classic ways you see in the TV movies and Sherlock Holmes, you have a bunch of things on a wall and you move them around and you draw lines between them. Mm-hmm. So this is something where we are, you know, we lay things out and how they're connected on the wall. And that's when we come back and, you know, we literally see the big picture of how things are framed. And that's the note taking, which is valuable, one which is on a wall far more than one which is across a whole bunch of little pages. And we've got to go through that. We are trying to bring ourselves to see the big picture and how things are connected, whether that's on a page or even better on a wall, then yes, it helps us to see all those connections.
I mean, that also makes me think of the research I've seen around what we're perceiving in terms of information when we're looking at something on our phone, as opposed to when we're like in a vast canyon, and it's completely different. We actually are limiting ourselves by making our frame smaller. And I've had bosses in the past who they only did their work on their phone. And I'm like, at least can you go to a desktop? At least can you make it a little bit bigger? Because, and I think the thinking that I saw in particular with these humans is that it did. It limited their ability to see widely.
And one of the points I also bring out in the book is around peripheral attention, where our attention can be focused very tightly on one thing in front of us, or it can be in our whole field of view. And, you know, it is a very specific technique which we can use to get ourselves into a relaxed state, into an open state, is simply to be looking straight ahead and to push our attention to see what it is we can see at the side peripheries of our vision. And this is, it's a not just a practice, it's also a metaphor. We need to be pushing ourselves to see the peripheries. And the more, again, this is part of this cycle. Yes, we need to cycle. Sometimes we tightly focus, yes, sometimes we need to be pushed out our attention as broadly as possible. And I also point in, you know, the introduction of the book around the paradoxes. You know, there are many paradoxes of being able to thrive in a world of information overload. And one of those is that interplay or that cycle between, yes, we need to be focused, and yes, we need to have very broad attention. Yes, we need to be able to see all of the minutiae and the details, and we also need to see the big picture. We need to be going between these states in order to be able to be a value. And focus does, you know, maybe sometimes very tight things. Yes, I only see one thing right in front of me. That's sometimes that has its purpose.
If you're trying
sometimes
to get a baseball,
we need to move to the big picture.
Yeah. In the chapter on the power of filtering, you introduce us to Claude Shannon, who I just found what a fascinating figure. Can you tell us about him?
So Claude Shannon is an idol of anybody in information and computing. You know, he's one of the godfathers. He wrote a paper called Information Theory, and he came up with the idea of a bit, which are now bytes and terabytes and so on. And so he worked for Bell Labs. He was a researcher, an incredibly creative person. You know, he's on the use of hobnob with Einstein and so on, and throwing around ideas. So he lived in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, not far from the Bell Labs research. And, you know, his one passion was music. So he used to go out to jazz bars late at night and, frequent things. And he was a bit of an introvert, but he loved his music. So when he was at home, he had his record player and his clarinet and his piano, but it got very cold one winter. And so he chopped up his piano and burnt it. But he still had his clarinet and his record player, and he played his record player very loud. And downstairs, neighbor came up and knocked on his door and ended up in a romance. And she ended up being an incredible, a leading psychiatrist, in this whole world of ideas. But his insight was around what information is. Really, this was groundbreaking at the time, foundation for all of information and communication we have, the foundation of communication. And he worked on this principle of, at the time, we had telephone lines were very noisy, and he wanted to be able to make sure that we had the signal, what we could actually hear people say, was sufficiently greater than the noise, the background noise. And this is a great way of thinking about the world we live in. There's an extraordinary amount of noise, more than ever before, and we need to be able to perceive the signal out of that.
There's another character in this chapter, Dietrich Machitz, who I think is an incredible illustration of someone who has this sort of pain point, but then sort of throws them into a place of unknown to them, and then really sees, like, is able to, you know. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, well, again, this is around focus versus breadth of vision. A lot of people just say, okay, I'm busy, I've got to get here, I'm going along there, and I get from A to B, and there I am. Other people actually look around to see the world, and that turns out to be sometimes extraordinarily valuable. So Dietrich Machitz was essentially a toothpaste, I believe it was, a marketer, and he ended up in Bangkok. And for those who haven't been to Bangkok, the roads are very, very busy, and getting around in cars is very slow. So they have what are called tuk-tuks, these three-wheeled motorcycles where you get in the back of a little seat and the driver drives you around to wherever you want. And the city is filled with these, all very colorful and ways of getting around. So Dietrich Machitz got into a tuk-tuk to get around, because that's the way he got around in Bangkok. And he noticed that his driver was drinking this drink. And he noticed that other tuk-tuk drivers were drinking this drink. And so he asked about it. He says, what are you drinking? And they told him what it was, or wrote it down so that he'd go back to his hotel and check out what it was. And these are people that get up very early. They work very long hours in order to be able to make a living. And so he found out what it was and went to the manufacturer, and translated the name of it was Red Bull. So he licensed the beverage, this caffeinated sugary beverage, which kept people awake. And he set up a company called Red Bull. And now there's more cans of Red Bull sold than there are people on the planet. So he looked around. He saw something. He saw an opportunity. He took it. And he got rather wealthy as a result.
Yeah, amazing. In the last two chapters, Power of Attention and Power of Synthesis, I'd love you to sort of help us continue to myth bust things. And the first is in the Power of Attention, multitasking. Is that a thing?
It, in fact, does not exist. Well, it does exist in a number of things. So we can walk and chew gum at the same time, hopefully. And we can also chop vegetables while we listen to a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But for anything which is cognitive, in fact, what is happening when we think we're doing two things at the same time, our brain is switching between the two tasks. And more recent studies using fMRI have actually demonstrated clearly that our brain is not active at two things at the same one time. It is switching between those two tasks. And there is a cost to switching between tasks. We need to finish one task, you resume the other tasks and switch between them. So in fact, it is extraordinarily inefficient. And there are research has shown that if you put in multitasking situations, people who believe they are good at multitasking, people believe they aren't good at multitasking, the people who believe they are good at multitasking don't perform as well.
Right.
Because they're essentially trying to do something which is not possible, where the ones that don't believe they can multitask do it in a more effective manner.
Okay, and the other one is Myers-Briggs.
So, the story behind Myers-Briggs is lovely, where essentially Catherine Myers was wanting to keep a relationship with her daughter who'd married Mr. Briggs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who had a very different personality. So he was trying to uncover that. So she was inspired with the structure of the Myers-Briggs from Carl Jung's psychological types. And I love Carl Jung's work. And I think that actually does relate a lot to improv in the sense of the way he looked at the nature of the unconscious and how that can be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, essentially his consideration, you know, his thinking about things rather than being based on research. And so the Myers-Briggs, I think, subtracted one of the psychological types of Jung. They sort of played around with it a bit and came up with something. And it's pretty solid. So I think there's a large proportion of people who have been in corporate world have taken a Myers-Briggs test at some time and they know what they are. You know, whether the extrovert or, you know, extrovert, introvert, the, you know, intuitive sensor, thinker, feeler, or judge, perceiver. And that is, can be useful typology. However, that has been transcended by more data-based research, mm-hmm. where essentially a number of different types of researchers and taking different approaches have tried to unpack what is the scope of the variation in human personalities. And so they have come up with a different framework. And this is consistently, time over time again, they've found that. And there is a little bit of overlap with the Myers-Briggs, but essentially it's what often called the OCEAN framework, which is around the degree of openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness and neuroticism. And so this is now a far more rigorous framework in being able to say across each of those different types, even those different personality types, you know, we have differences in our personality. Some people are more neurotic than others. Some people are more agreeable than others by their nature. But while I was pointing particularly to openness experience as one of the fundamental drivers of value, and there's a wealth of research showing that those people who are more open to experience, essentially more successful and happier and more engaged with the world. But across all of those things, these are not fixed. And I think that's one of the real insights from more recent understanding of you know, psychology and personality, is that the way we are when we are born, the way we are when you're young, the way we are in school, is not necessarily even who we are. We can then have choice. We have volition. We can change who we are in order to build our personality, some which is more functional and helps us, leaves us happier. And that's something we can evolve over time. And I think that, you know, improv, again, is something which can facilitate us in developing some of the personality traits that can advantage us and, you know, make us happier in life.
Yeah, I think so too, obviously. And the other thing is, you know, we're as human beings as storytelling machines, we know that. And then we're such unreliable narrators of our own stories. And I know that for myself, I've been caught so many times where I've been like, hey, remember when I did this thing? And the person I'm talking to goes, no, I did that thing. And I'm like, you're right. I did not do that thing. And this has been a process of self-discovery over my, you know, 56 years that I've been alive. I don't know. I think at first it felt like a sad burden, and now I kind of find it joyful and weird. And I think that's in the way that you write in the book, quote, problems are the spark for invention. So this is just a problem that presents itself potentially as an opportunity.
Yeah, I certainly think so. We are becoming, as I said before. You know, we see ourselves on a journey of becoming, then that begs the question, who do I want to become?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. All right. In a moment I'm gonna ask you for a yes and story, but before we do that, I really loved this phrase that came from Reed Hastings, where he talks about farming for dissent. Because a thing I've noticed over time is like human beings aren't crazy about dissent, especially in the world of business. And I started working with this new executive on our team, and man, this dude farms for dissent, like in a very positive way of like, this isn't personal. This is about challenging us all to be our best selves. But I just realized in working with him how rare that has been that I've seen that at the leadership level.
Yeah. So Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix. And part of this came from a big mistake. They made a massive mistake along the way, destroyed an immense amount of value. And he realized that, yeah, everyone was saying, okay, yeah, people disagreed with the idea, but they weren't really voicing their, disagreement with it. And so I think I love that word farming though. It's like, yeah, you're cultivating it and saying, all right, well, we're going to grow this. Mm-hmm. This is something which we need to nurture and is alive. It's not saying, okay, just.
And every year there's a good, you know, right? It's like, this doesn't stop.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 Well, again, it's the bane of so much in business. And, you know, when we're improvising and there are no mistakes, because you just have to use what's in front of you, you're not in that brain. You're not in your judgment brain of self or others. You're just doing. And then often it's when you step down from the stage and you have a director or a coach who's also going, oh my, like that was, let's script that, you know, like we have something, we made something. And those spaces are not rare in theaters like ours, but they are rare in a lot of companies, unfortunately. So.
Yes. And, you know, more broadly, those companies that are better performing over the long run are the ones where those kinds of conversations are not just accepted, but welcomed.
That's right. All right. We always end the podcast asking for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Well, yes, I do. So this is
no, I don't.
Long ago. Well, a little while ago. So this was it was around a table, and this was early on during COVID, and a mate of mine had his office in a wonderful space where I live, Bondi Beach, and he's had to move out. So he's, okay, we've got to move out of our space. We can't keep our business going there. We're going to go remote. And I, this is, you know, do you want to use it? This is, whoa, well, you know, I've got way too much on, but that's something I have to say yes to. And I'm going to make that into an innovation hub. And it's going, it's I just gotta go all the way with this, get my business, you know, find a business partner to come into this with and to build it and to make it. So the aftermath of that is a completely different story, but it was one of those times when...
Is it a happy story or a not so happy story?
Not so happy, actually.
Okay, good.
But, you know, COVID again sort of wrought its wrath on us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's happy bits along the way, of course, as well. You know, it's endings are not the entire story. But, yeah, it's kind of this... It's interesting because I'm a sucker for things that are worth doing. And I sometimes say yes more than things, but I am also, yeah, I also try to constrain things. I always want to say, okay, look, I've already got too much on. I do need to learn to say no. And so there is this cycling between this no and sort of this idea sometimes, which is so compelling, you have to say yes.
I think you can yes and yourself. And in yes anding yourself to say a no is being true to yourself in terms of like, no, yes, I love this idea and I can't do it. Like I just, you know, I know for myself, and it's probably a matter of age and the time we live and all that. Like I can't be out like 4 or 5 nights in a row, which of course I am this week. And I'm looking at my calendar going, what did I do? And they're all things that I want to do. We have an international film festival. We've got concert. It's a wonderful meal. I'm going to enjoy all these. I know, but I also know, as much of as I am an extrovert, there's an introvert part of me, again, because that's true, that needs space to sit in my garden. And I'm not going to have that time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's part of the and as well, is it's both of those.
That's right. The book is called Thriving on Overload, The 5 Powers for Success in a World of Exponential Information. Ross Dawson, thank you for coming on the show.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
survive.